This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. Host log, supplemental, stardate 1292.9. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode 212. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. We cover everything from movies and television to books, apps, and websites. Joining me tonight, Alistair McFly.
OhMyZod.com.
Hello. Hey, I know you haven't updated in a while, so I thought I would at least encourage our listeners to go to OhMyZod.com and bug you to update.
Thank you. Yes.
No pressure.
I've been wanting to. It's getting the time, as usually the case with things like that.
Yeah, no, of course. And if you invent the 36-hour day, I call dibs on the next next one. If you get one, I want the next one, because I also need some time. It seems like it's just par for the course these days. Whenever I talk to people, it's always like, how are you? I'm busy. It seems to be what's going on. So what's new? It's been a little while since I've had you on the show.
It has been, yes. Yes, I have a table now. I'm finally adulting. I now have a dining room table, and that has been a big thing in my life. I've reached that point of my 30s where I'm excited about a table.
I remember that. I bought coffee tables a few years ago. Well, I say a few. It's probably closer to 8 or 10 now. But when I got them, it was like the first new thing that I was buying. It wasn't a hand-me-down. It wasn't a flea market thing. It wasn't, Kijiji. It was like, I went to the furniture store. I saw the ones with the glass and the stone, and I said, I want those. And I brought them home. Yeah. And then you get home, and you're like, shit, I'm really excited about coffee tables. This is really boring. Why? When did I become the guy that's excited about coffee tables? So do tell. What did you get for a dining room table?
I had 3 sofas, so I sold 2 of them and managed to completely break even on just one that I got from Kijiji.
Oh, nice.
So I just bought it online, and it didn't really cost me anything.
That's great.
So I
got my dining room table was a Kijiji thing, too. Someone had picked it up from, I think it was originally a superstore buy, and then they were moving into a new house that they didn't expect to, and it was too small. They had this giant new dining room, and they had this 4-person dining room table that just looked ridiculous in the room. So I brought it home. How was your Kijiji experience? Because I haven't done this in a long time, and I do have some stuff I have to get rid of. Like, is it easier now than it used to be, or is it just as painful?
I've probably not been here long enough to be able to answer that. Right. It's been relatively easy. There's a lot of people kind of lowballing you for a lot of stuff. Mm. And, will you take like half of the price, or less than that? So I've had people offer me a fifth, and it's just like, no, I want to break even at least. But it was relatively pleasant, and everybody I bought from was just fantastic. So that's been great. But I mean, the big thing for me was just that I needed somewhere for board games. I originally bought a large coffee table, hoping that'll be big enough, which it is. But it's just gaming whilst kneeling on the floor, not the best experience.
No.
So having an actual dining room table I can sit at rather than just my breakfast bar and being able to play games, that's been the big point for me, really.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think the only board game / card game that I've played around a coffee table where I was comfortable was Cards Against Humanity. Mm. Because you don't really need a flat surface in front of you all the time. You just need something to put your cards down on and a place to keep score. Like, it's not the end of the world. Where whenever I've played Munchkin or Catan, it's always been at a kitchen table or at a dining room table. It's much more comfortable to sit up. Because they're not, it's not as low. I think that's the main issue. Mm. Yeah.
Are you familiar with Cyanide and Happiness?
Yes, the comic strip.
Yes. They're releasing a new game. I got it on Kickstarter.
I saw that the other day.
Called Joking Hazard. Yeah, so it plays very much like Cards Against Humanity, but it's based on their comic book generator.
Oh, interesting.
So basically, there's 3 panels, just like a lot of their comics. One is just played on the table. The judge plays the second, and then everybody plays the third, and the judge chooses the funniest stuff. And it is fantastic. I mean, it's as rude and hilarious as the website itself.
Yeah.
I just received my Kickstarter pack for it, and they're going to be going on sale pretty soon, and I'm hoping to be able to play that tomorrow. So I'll let you know how that goes.
Yeah, no, please do, because that's as a comic strip creator, like someone that writes and draws them when I have the time. See aforementioned comment about time. it would be a really eye-opening experience, I think, to get some non-comic writers around the table, just smart, witty people, you know, see what they came up with. I imagine there's a lot of non sequiturs that kind of party writing.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing as well is that with Cards Against Humanity, if you've played it enough, it does get a bit dull because all the answers become the same. I ended up buying every single expansion and I've reached that point again and there's no new cards.
Yeah.
And I can't come up with anything funny for the blank ones. So having this is really, really good. It seems really funny. And if you get a chance to just check it out, it's called Joking Hazard. I believe it's jokinghazardgame.com, though I might be wrong on that.
I'm sure with those guys, the Google search will get you to the right, at least the Kickstarter page. And
easily
the top search for sure. I think there was another, the Oatmeal has got another game Kickstartering right now. I don't necessarily think it's him, but he's the artist involved. Whether or not he's the game designer, I don't know, but there's another one. Because there was, Exploding Kittens, I think, was the first one, or was that somebody else?
Yes, I played that actually just a few weeks ago, and that was fantastic.
Yeah, I've been meaning, I was talking to a friend the other day, and I've been meaning to go to the Boardroom Cafe when I have some evenings off and check it out and get a couple of people together and go try some new stuff. Because I'm in the boat where I would like to try to play Munchkin again with some people that enjoy that kind of game, especially if they're people that have played Warcraft or Dungeons and Dragons before. Like, I feel like that would be a really fun crew to play a board game. And then I like Catan as well. Like that's a fun game. And like you, now that I have this table to actually do stuff on, although here's the funny thing, I don't eat at the table. I eat in the living room. But the giant dining room table that I have just kind of collects stuff. Usually it's mail and, you know, my backpack sits on one of the chairs for when I leave and grab it on my way out. Like, just it's become a very large entryway table as opposed to an actual place to eat. Although I sit, and whenever my parents stop by, I sit and have coffee or breakfast with them. That's where we sit, is at the table. But yeah, so if folks are wondering about the top of the show and why I read today's entry like a star date, is because there's a very specific reason that I wanted to have Alistair on the show. And that is over the last, I guess, say month or so, I've been watching Star Trek Enterprise. And I know that Alistair is very knowledgeable in the world of Star Trek. And more recently, just in our off-mic talks about Star Trek Enterprise. So you've obviously seen the series probably when it was on TV, and maybe, how many times have you watched the series? More than once?
I've lost track.
Okay.
It's one of those things where with all of the series, I'll often put it on as background stuff. I'll have it on to go to sleep to.
Right.
I've had that filter into dreams, which is entertainingly weird and weirdly entertaining. I lose track in all honesty.
Cool. Well, I haven't watched a Star Trek television series. Probably, I watched a couple of episodes of Enterprise when it was first on TV back in like 2001. Because it was on immediately after Smallville here in Canada. So it was very easy to just kind of like stay on sci-fi and keep on watching. But I didn't stick with it. And I had since forgot everything. I recognized characters. Like I remember T'Pol and I remember Phlox and I remember all those people. But I'd never remembered them as their character. I just remembered the physical appearance of them. So it was a brand new experience for me going through with Enterprise. And the last Star Trek that I watched before that would have been Voyager, I guess. And that would have been back in university, probably around 2001. So, and I liked Voyager well enough. It wasn't my favorite, but it wasn't bad. I liked it better than Deep Space Nine. I never did finish Deep Space Nine. So I found it interesting that I enjoyed a prequel like Enterprise as much as I did.
And if I recall, you said you've never seen the original series.
I haven't. I've seen the original movies. So the Kirk Nimoy, you know, Wrath of Khan, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I've seen all of those a number of times. They were on TV a lot when I was a kid. And I would have rented them on Beta back when renting movies was a thing that I did with my dad on the weekends when I was 10. And I went through the Star Wars and Star Trek and stuff like that. Dad and I went to go see, I think it was Undiscovered Country in theaters. I think I remember doing that. And I enjoy them. And I enjoy the new movies as well. And Enterprise kind of bridges that gap, I feel, between the new movies and, say, Next Generation, as far as like a television show. Is like there's that exploration and that science stuff, which is their core mission, but there's an awful lot of action in Star Trek Enterprise, which I thought was really cool. And I guess before I get too much into this, I want to throw out a spoiler warning. We're going to talk about all four seasons, potentially revealing plot stuff. So if you haven't seen Enterprise, you might want to tune out. I just don't want to have to hop, skip, and jump around everything. I'm just going to go ahead and say stuff. So you've been warned, people.
Easier for me as well.
Yeah. And of course. Like, I mean, I've seen it. I've seen it all. I've watched all four seasons. The only thing that I did not watch, and you're going to laugh at this, was two episodes in season four where everybody is an alternate evil version of themselves.
In a mirror darkly. Yes. Yeah.
It was terrible. I
remember you sent me a text message saying, do I have to watch these? And I remember responding with, yes, you do.
Yes. I ignored you. I was like, please, he's going to tell me something really quippy, like, nah, they're fun, but you don't have to. Or he's going to be really nice about it. And he's like, no, you must watch these. And screw you, Alistair. I'm not going to. Wasn't the answer I was looking for. I'm not going to. So I tried. I watched maybe 20 minutes, and it took me 45 minutes to watch that 20 minutes because I was like, I was on my phone and I was distracted by getting up and getting dinner. Like I could not do it. So I thought, all right, I am going to go ahead and read the synopses for these episodes on Wikipedia. If there's anything interesting that I feel like I should probably see, then I will go back and I will watch it. But I didn't. I just continued. There was only a couple more episodes in the final season. So I just went ahead and did that.
Yeah.
It wasn't really my cup of tea.
It was, it's really one for the fans, that one. So it all kind of is based on an original series episode, which obviously you won't have seen,
right?
Called The Tholian Web. And it has a race of aliens called the Tholians, and they capture a ship called the USS Defiant. And that ends up disappearing into some other dimension. And so that's the ship that appears in that episode. There's also another episode called Mirror Mirror, which is the main one that it's based on, hence the name In a Mirror Darkly, where Kirk and the rest of his away team end up beaming over to the Enterprise, but they get switched with their counterparts in a mirror universe. And so this is where you may have seen Spock with a beard. Basically, they're all evil in that parallel dimension, and we've got them all good. And so he's basically kind of trying to go around and trying to change their society and encourage Spock to go away from all of these kind of things. And they picked that up later on in Deep Space Nine to see the kind of effect that Kirk had in that universe. And it ended up with humanity actually getting the real short end of the straw because we were suddenly weak. You know, as the Federation, and the Klingons and the Cardassians united to overthrow everyone.
Wow.
But this is all a prequel. So this is all set in that mirror universe, but there's no crossing over like we've had before. This is all entirely based in that. So they did this as a two-part episode with plans that for the next season, they would continue and have a few more episodes set in that universe.
Yeah.
But the idea is it's supposed to be that they're dark. Basically, everybody gets promoted, usually through assassination.
Yeah, and it's very, just polar opposites. Like no subtlety at all about the switching. It's just everybody's just kind of playing against type. And my argument there is that the cast of Enterprise was actually pretty well casted. And so when they go to play against type, I don't buy it for a minute. Like it just it just doesn't. It's like Hoshi is playing this like slutty, you know, manipulative mistress. I'm just like, nope. she's one of my favorite characters, and I like her because she's so sweet. Like it just there's just did not work for me.
One of the problems with Star Trek is that doing sex is something that they've not managed to sell since the 60s.
Yeah.
You know,
I remember a steamy bubble bath with Riker and Deanna Troi at one point. Something about shaving a beard. I can't, yeah. Anyway, I remember watching that on
that was Star Trek Insurrection. Yes.
Oh, okay. I remember watching that at some point when I was younger. So I'm like, oh, good. Finally, the tension on the set is now relieved.
There was an episode, I've forgotten which one it was, but there was an episode where T'Pol disrobes and you see her you see her naked rear behind.
Oh no, I don't remember that.
And in the trailers they had it there and there was so much outcry that they had to crop it when it was broadcast.
Huh.
Just because there was so much outcry at her bare bottom being shown.
I don't remember anything too racy in that, but I tended to tune that out because they did it a lot with T'Pol during the series. I mean, it's one of my kind of Star Trek beefs with, I think it started with, well, I guess it probably started with Troi, but it continued with Seven of Nine and Voyager, and it went on with T'Pol, in Enterprise. Although I like the fact that at least T'Pol, the character herself is presented quite often as, obviously intelligent science officer, Vulcan. Like she's second in command. She can hold her own for sure. Yes. But the outfits they put her in. Yeah. Well, actually I shouldn't say that because the Vulcan stuff that she wears, even when she becomes a Starfleet officer, it's still very authentically Vulcan. They all just wear tight stuff. It doesn't really, you know, the guys
that's
wear
it.
Robes.
It's just the tight fitting.
Yeah, it's just
costume.
The tight fitting
that's
costume.
Yeah.
But in Enterprise itself, any opportunity that they could have to write T'Pol and insert crew member here in the biohazard room, rubbing, you know, decontamination gel all over one another was like, really? This is like episode one and a half? Like, I can't even remember if we got through the first episode and it was, oh, okay, and we're all naked and we're covered in jello. This is a nerd's wet dream. Like, come on. So that kind of stuff I found a little wanting. I did enjoy the first season. Like, I mean, for a first season of a Star Trek series, I enjoyed it. I liked the fact that there was no prime directive.
Yes.
That Archer was flying by the seat of his pants, which is very much like Kirk. There was a lot of positivity in the first season. They went out and they were just like, hey, who are you? We're a human. Nice to meet you. You know, like, it was very Canadian. You know, like it was,
yes.
That kind of stuff. And they would, different cultures and things like that. They had all these different, you know, surprises and whatnot. And I remember there was one really weird one with like a crystal hand basket. And then Tucker got pregnant, and he was carrying a fetus on his rib cage. Like it was just
unexpected. I think that was called
out to lunch. Like it did some stuff, some really really weird stuff like that. But I liked it. I mean, my concern in the beginning, I think I've mentioned on Citadel Cafe before, was that I was worried that T'Pol was going to get old really fast in terms of just wooden, non-emotional Vulcan acting. Not because Julian Blaylock wasn't capable, but because that tends to be how they write Vulcans a lot of the time. And my concern came from how they were writing all of the other Vulcans. The, not the counselor, what was his name? Ambassador.
Saval,
right. So ambassadors and all the other politicians and stuff were all pretty staunch, right?
So, yeah, I mean, And I do like what they did with the Vulcans later on, because they had the Vulcan High Command, which didn't exist in any other series.
Yeah.
And logic was not as... It was basically one of those ideals that they didn't really stick to. And, you know, the idea of... I've forgotten the Vulcan... thing for it, but basically just trying to push down emotion wasn't as big of a thing. The mind melding was considered an abomination
yeah.
amongst Vulcans and things. Yeah. And it was good that they kind of got to this point where society changed and you saw that society change for the better, that they were still a little bit more on their violent roots, because the Vulcans were one of the most emotionally driven species in the Star Trek universe. It's just that they bottle it all up and push it all down and focus more on logic, because without it, they are some of the most violent beings that there are. And yeah. it's kind of a little bit like how we've had a very barbaric past.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to stay away from that and try to be a bit more positive thinking. But it's that kind of contrast there. And so I thought that was quite interesting for them to do.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it was mirrored in the emotional journey that T'Pol went on over the course of the four seasons. Like, you don't notice it until the last season, really. I guess season three especially, but there was a lot in season four as well.
Yeah, season three brings up a lot of the fact that when they're in the Expanse, that changes her.
Yeah.
And she loses a lot of that self-control. There's also plans that Manny Coto, who was the writer for season three and season four, and one of the co-executive producers, he was actually planning the Romulan War for season five. In that, they were going to reveal that T'Pol was actually half Romulan. And that's why she had even less control over her emotions, that she wasn't purely Vulcan, in the same way that Spock is half human. But she would have been half Romulan as well.
Right. Yeah, and they touched on the Romulan stuff. Season four? Or did it come in season three?
They had season two, right at the beginning, they had Minefield.
Right.
There's a couple of Romulan ships there. But there was a meeting with a Romulan in season four, and that was supposed to be laying the groundwork for season five, which sadly never happened.
Well, season four, there was this remote control ship, and they were using not Tellarites, Andorians.
Yes.
It was a species of Andorian, like a white telepathic.
Yes, I forgot
version.
What they're called.
I don't remember either. But again, like, it's very, very cool. there was so much to the series in terms of the alien races and the building of the relationships between humans and Tellarites and Andorians and Vulcans. I love the fact that humans don't like Vulcans. Like, I thought it was just like, it was like, you have the shit we need, but you won't help. So you're no help. Thanks a lot. Screw you. Like, I really enjoyed that kind of mentality. And at first you think it's just Tucker and Archer, because of the relationship that Archer's dad had with trying to develop warp drive and being held back by Vulcans. But like, it seems like a lot of the human characters felt the same way towards the Vulcans.
And it'd been several years. I mean, it'd been decades of
100 years, I think, is what they keep on saying in the show.
Yeah, and I do love how throughout it, Archer starts to understand why the Vulcans did what they did. They were perhaps a bit too pushy with that, but he got to understand the reasoning behind it when he started making the mistakes that, you know, that they were trying to prevent.
Yeah, and I like that there was tough calls. Like, I enjoyed, certainly after season three starts, after the big attack on Earth, which I don't necessarily know if I really, I mean, I bought it, but it wasn't, it seemed like if the Zindi was going to develop a prototype and test it on something, why the hell would you test it on Earth and give everybody a heads up? Like, it just, I know it served the plot, like it got them to go to the Expanse, but I kind of thought, like, all the testing they were doing in the Expanse and blowing up moons, that makes sense. You know, and then you say, okay, well, it works. That was big enough to destroy Earth, so let's go destroy Earth. Not like, you know, it's like sneaking up on somebody and in the action movies, and right before you punch them, you go, you know, like, it's stupid, you know, just take the guy out.
For shock value, though, because of how season two had been, I mean, season one, they were trying to do a lot of, you know, actual on location shooting outdoors rather than it being inside with these fake scenery and things that you'd seen on previous series. Mm-hmm. But season two had become more of a show set on the ship for the most part, and it wasn't really feeling like it was going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly this was just a huge shift in things. It was also trying to follow on from the events of 9/11, and it was responding to that. Star Trek has always been about what's happening now.
Right.
You know, the idea of the Romulans was the idea of the Cold War back in the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, and so suddenly we've got 9/11 and these terrorist attacks, and they were mimicking that. So season three was all about that kind of journey and about wanting to get revenge and to try and stop more atrocities and all of this kind of stuff. So from a societal point of view, it's actually quite an important season for Star Trek. Just related to everything that was going on at the time.
Yeah.
And it just shows how much that changed the show.
Oh, for sure. And I think for the better. Like, I really enjoyed the season-long arc. Almost every episode was meant to propel the main plot forward. You know, there was subplots within it, but it wasn't like you'd see on a lot of television right now where there's villain of the week or problem of the week or a new character of the week. And then somewhere in the 45 minutes, you get about 5 or 10 little plot points that move the main, you know, kind of villain or main thing forward. Whereas this, I felt, was the opposite. I felt like there would be a social story happening on the Enterprise, like, I don't know, T'Pol and Tucker flirting, or, you know, his sleep therapy or something like that, where it was low key. It was a break from the seriousness of the Zindi and the spheres and this time travel asshole that kept on showing up and driving me crazy. it's one thing when you have time travel that's handled, and I know we've talked about this before, but like Back to the Future, where you have to get in a thing and you have to hit 88 miles an hour, and there's all these different factors that have to line up just to be able to do it at all. Whereas in Star Trek, I can't remember the name of the guy that's the time traveler. He's known. I don't even know if I ever know his real name. Daniels. Yeah. So Daniels just kind of shows up. And so Archer will walk through a door on a ship and walk out of the door in 400 years in the future. And he's like, oh, damn it. And then I've never enjoyed any Star Trek time travel stuff. It's always so convoluted. And I appreciate the fact that they're trying to stay true to, like, what we understand time travel to be as far as physics and science and like how it really happened, and you wouldn't experience anything. It would just like happen, you know? So I get what they're trying, but it makes for bad TV.
It also, you ended up with Archer just going, look, no more of this, just leave me alone. And I really feel that was the writers as well, just going, look, we've had enough as well.
You know,
because the thing is that they never wanted it to begin with. The time travel storyline was all network interference. Mm. So I was at Star Trek London a few years ago back in the UK, and there was a few people doing talks there. Brannon Braga, one of the co-creators, was talking about the show as well. And he was saying that the whole point for season one was that it was all going to be set on Earth. There'll be more of that kind of conflict with the Vulcans. Mm-hmm. And it would be all about them getting ready to launch. And so the end of season one was going to be the ship launching. The network went, no, we want it in space. You have to get them there to space at the end of the pilot. So they have their 2-hour pilot, and they basically had to rush what they would plan for, what they were wanting to do for a whole season, into that first episode, and then launch them into space there. The network also went, oh, and we want time travel, because people love time travel. And so they threw in this future guy, and they really didn't know what they were going to do with it. But it was just something that the network had forced upon them. Now, before Star Trek had started off as a network show, it then became syndicated for Star Trek The Next Generation and so on. And then suddenly for Enterprise, it's back as a network show with UPN. And they had a lot of push over what happened. So it wasn't quite the show that they had originally envisioned. And things like the time travel stuff ended up doing more harm than good.
Yeah, it feels very slapped in there. And when you have that kind of time travel stuff, I mean, like when someone has a reset button, like it really doesn't, there's no peril, you know, like, it doesn't really make for any kind of suspense. Although I have to say, even though I was pretty sure about, you know, the main crew, as far as I was concerned, not having any real major departures as far as anybody dying or leaving over the course of the seasons. And that could have just been like, maybe I happened to catch an episode of season four way back when it was on TV. So I just subconsciously remembered that no one died. but it was at least interesting in season three, because they'd get into a situation, you're just like, so I know that the whole ship is going to blow up because it's season three and there's a season four. So like, I get that we're going to survive this, but I don't know how. Like they were in some seriously tight scrapes, and that's what made it really interesting. It's like, okay. So then it became this really cool combination, especially in season three with all the Zindi stuff about, being more aggressive with the ship, shooting and asking questions later, and the combination of like T'Pol and Tucker and somebody else, probably, I can't remember the ensign that flies the thing. I like him a lot though. Not Sato. Sato's the communications officer. Who's the helmsman?
That is Mayweather.
Yeah. So like Mayweather and Tucker would come up with some ingenious way of like, getting the ship to go faster or deflecting something and doing stuff. And it became really cool because the whole crew had to sort it out. It wasn't just like the captain's call and he saved the day. It was like everybody was of equal value. And that's something I really enjoyed about that season with the Zindi. And something else I liked was the division amongst the Zindi. So, I mean, for those that are hanging out with us and not having seen Enterprise, Zindi are the race that attack Earth at the end of season two. They cut this great big laser swath through South Florida and I think Virginia, I can't remember, but they kill a lot of people. And
that's the key point there.
Yeah. Earth gets mad and sends Enterprise to go stop the shitstorm. And, where was I going with this? Season three.
Zindi.
Right. So, but the Zindi are not one race. Their home is no more. They lost their home planet, but they were five races or six races?
Yes. There was originally five, and then one of them became extinct. They were, the species that were kind of like birds.
Yeah. The avians, I think they call them.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So the avians, and the skull of an avian looks kind of like a dinosaur. I'm kind of bummed that we didn't get some sort of flashback so I could actually see what they look like. But then there's like a reptilian version. There's an insectoid, which is weird. And then, what was the other one? Arboreal.
Yeah.
And what do they call the ones that look like humans? Apes?
I think they were just humanoid. I can't remember what the term for them was. Oh, but there was also the amphibian ones as well.
Oh, right.
No, so maybe it was six.
There were five. Yeah. That makes sense. And that's cool because like the amphibian water ones, when they speak, it sounds like, you know, porpoises and whales and stuff like that. When the insectoids speak, it's a lot of clicking and buzzing and stuff like that. And that all gets translated. And then the reptiles, of course, anybody that's in like a human in makeup is just kind of speaking English. Although I have to say the makeup in this show was both good and bad. It got really good in season three and four, but in season one and two, there was a lot of points where it's like, oh, you stopped the makeup halfway down his neck and you didn't talk to the costume department because his, you know, blazer jacket thing has got this really deep V-neck. So his skin goes from orange to regular human, right about his Adam's apple.
but one of the things I find amazing though with Star Trek is how many races they've had to design makeup for. Like they've had such a huge variety of aliens, and you know, they never seem to run out of looks and styles.
And I'm glad,
you know, sometimes it's just little minor differences, but at the same time that has got to be challenging to come up with even more races than we've ever seen before.
Oh, absolutely. And what I really liked about the Zindi is that the Homo sapien ones, the arboreal ones, and the reptile ones, even though they looked very different, they had the same bone structure. Like you could look at them and they had the same cheek ridges and the same temple ridges, more pronounced on the arboreals and the lizard people, but less so on the people that look more like humans. But it was all in the same space. Like it was all in the same spot on the head. It was just like exaggerated or not. The insectoids and the aquatics didn't really look like the other races. So like they were kind of the offshoot, but they were also the ones that were CG.
Yes.
So they had that going on. And I have to say, you know, for a TV show that was done 10 plus years ago, they weren't bad.
No, not at all.
The suspension of disbelief was there. Like, I didn't really have to push that hard.
Mm.
You know, like, if you just kind of sat back and watched it, it was good. I liked the fact that it was, like, that they didn't speak English. Because, I mean, something that I've always kind of felt funny about Star Trek, and it's because it's just better TV if there's no subtitles and everybody just speaks English, and you just have to say it a couple times in the season, each season, that there's a universal translator and that's how we know what you're saying. And then everybody can just speak English and you don't have to worry about it. But I like the fact that because it's Enterprise, because it's the prequel and the first time that everybody's encountering all these different species, for the first few minutes of encountering somebody, they have to get the universal translator to collect the words and then start working. So there's always this moment where they can't speak to one another.
Yeah, or you're really relying on Hoshi just to get the concept of the language down to try and at least figure out some way of forming a greeting.
Yeah, yeah, and there was always
to get the ship destroyed in the process.
Yeah, and there was always those fun moments where, like, there's a lot of clicks and whirs and buzzes and stuff like that, and Archer looks at Hoshi, and Hoshi's like, you don't want to know what he said. It's like, that was pretty rude.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, I really enjoyed it. I think that as a whole, the action really stood out to me as something that I enjoyed a lot. There was a lot of shooting, a lot of flying around and maneuvers and things. In season four, especially, the writing, I felt the season wrapped up really fast. Did the show get canceled?
It did.
Yeah.
So they were allowed to finish the series, but the idea was that they were going to change it to being 2 and 3 episode arcs.
Yes.
Which I loved.
It was fantastic.
And story-wise, it really allowed them to get deeper into things without it feeling like things were dragging on as well. But yeah, in the end, they wrapped it up really, really quickly. And it was a shame because they knew that it was going to be the final season, and they could have actually started to do an underlying arc that kind of led to it. But you have Terra Prime, which is the penultimate episode, and they have a speech that Archer delivers at the end, which is absolutely fantastic. And then the whole show just takes a dive with the final episode.
Yeah.
And Brannon Braga actually, he pretty much apologized for that one. He said they completely dropped the ball. They thought that it would be a wonderful tribute to the whole of Star Trek to include Riker and Troy from Star Trek The Next Generation and try and tie it into things. But really what it did was that it didn't give the cast for Enterprise their own proper send-off.
Exactly my feelings, and, yeah.
Yeah, and you also have them saying like, oh, this was the best speech, we learned about it in Starfleet Academy, and then it cuts before you even hear one of the most famous speeches. So the show almost works better if you stop at the end of Terra Prime.
Right.
It almost feels like a better ending for it. The other problem that I had watching it was that you've got Riker, who's like, the whole point is that the entire episode is supposed to be a holodeck simulation. So in a way, you could even look back and just go, it wasn't even accurate. It was their own holodeck simulation rather than what was actually happening.
Right.
But Riker's trying to deal with a dilemma based on an episode in Star Trek Next Generation where he was involved with another captain on a ship in hiding a cloaking device, which was forbidden for Starfleet. It was illegal for them to ever use a cloaking device. And the main reason behind that was because Gene Roddenberry didn't want us to be sneaking around. It's like, that's what the Romulans do. We're humans, we're people, we don't sneak.
Mm-hmm.
We're not deceptive. So the reasoning was that it was all trade agreements and treaties, and so it was forbidden. And they got caught. And so Riker's trying to figure out, do I tell Picard that I was involved in this? You know, do I tell him what was going on? And in the Enterprise episode, he kind of decides that he's going to do it. In the Next Generation episode that it's based on, he doesn't make that decision, and Picard figures it out himself. So it doesn't even tie in properly.
Yeah.
Because you kind of go through all this, and it's like, well, you're still, you never made that decision to open up and spill the beans. Picard catches you out. So it didn't even tie in properly.
Yeah. And And if you're going to have two of the next generation and not the rest, like, I mean, I think Brent Spiner was in there in audio only. Data comes over the comm, I think, to speak to Troy at some point during the episode.
Yes. But,
and Spiner was on Enterprise playing Sung, or Sung's father, grandfather.
Yes. So, like, yeah, an ancestor of Data's creator.
Yeah, yeah, which was cool. But like, and I know that LeVar Burton directed a couple of Enterprise episodes. So there's been some people from Star Trek around. Like, if you're going to, I mean, I realize the show got canceled, but if you're going to write an episode like that, where you're going to tie in a bunch of people from Next Gen, like, get everybody. Even if Picard is behind a desk, like, he doesn't, even if he doesn't stand up, you know, like, you have to get everybody at some point into
it. But they shouldn't have done it. What they should have done is just kept it purely to do with Enterprise. You know, if they are having to skip ahead, go to the founding of the Federation, actually follow them through.
Yeah.
Whereas you have two things, they tied it in and completely deviated away from the main focus.
Yeah.
You know, and in the process, you lost any kind of sense of potential for loss for things.
Yeah, and it was also, it also just kind of, it, like, they built up to this great big moment, but then they fizzled.
Yeah, exactly. And you also have Tucker dying for the sake of it. He gets killed off, and it really doesn't even feel like, you can see what they're trying to do, that he's trying to make a sacrifice, and he's doing what he can. But at the same time, it feels meaningless and not even in a way that that you can justify so much.
No, I agree. It
seemed for the sake of it, just like, oh, this will make the ratings go better.
Yeah. Like, I remember after four seasons with Tucker, one of my favorite characters on the show, and he essentially dies in, you could call it an accident, or you could call it a stupid decision, which is what, which one, does Tucker doesn't make stupid decisions, you know,
he'd know better at that point. Yeah, absolutely. Like,
and you're telling me that one of the smartest engineers in Starfleet is being, is walking down a hall with, I don't know how many, were there three or four alien invaders and the captain, and neither one of them can figure out a way to get out of it besides blowing up Tucker like that. It just, it didn't make any sense. That's the other thing that I have a problem with, is that one issue with this whole series is, like, every time there's something really important or really dangerous, the most important people on the ship. I mean, I get it's a Star Trek thing, but it was really obvious in this particular series that, oh, who do we need to complete this mission? T'Pol. T'Pol is the only one with the smarts that can complete what we need to have done. Oh, we should send her down in a shuttle with all the laser fire going on. Yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that. It's like, well, wait, what? Send somebody else.
Yeah.
There's no red shirts, so you could, like, everybody had to go.
One thing that I have heard, which I've not read any of the books, but apparently they tried to undo that damage a little bit by suggesting that Tucker did this on purpose after being involved with Section 31.
So apparently
So Section 31 are the CD people in the shadows. They're a secret department of Starfleet.
So that's in Enterprise. Malcolm has been dealt with. Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So they never gave it a name. That's why I didn't know.
Right. So yeah. Well, they do identify themselves as Section 31. The idea is that when Section 31 was first introduced in Deep Space Nine, they said that they've been there since before the founding of the Federation. So they are in that. They were also in Star Trek Into Darkness. They're the secret underbelly of Starfleet that do all of that stuff there as well.
Right, so that I caught. Like, I caught the Into Darkness connection with the augments.
Yes.
Because they mention...
Well, that's also to do with Khan.
Yes.
The augments are basically from the Genetics Wars, which happened in, I believe, 1996.
Was it 96, really?
Well, the idea came in the 60s.
Cool.
So when you have Khan's first appearance on the original series, that's in the 60s, and they're like, yeah, and then in like 1996 there was this huge eugenics war, and you know, and then that all kind of got fizzled out, and they ended up in stasis and were sent into space and so on, and then later on discovered by Kirk and co, and then after deciding to leave them on a planet, that's when you end up with the Wrath of Khan,
right,
when the planet shifts orbit and the whole planet's almost destroyed, and he wants vengeance on Kirk. That's how that all comes about.
Right.
So they kind of had all of that. And the... I've completely forgotten what the... Oh, yeah, that was it. So Section 31. So the idea is that in the books, he apparently ends up continuing all of that. And so he basically fakes his own death.
Oh.
And becomes an undercover operative for them. So I've not read the book, so I don't know the details exactly, but that's my understanding of what the writers did to try and bring Tucker back for the fans.
Yeah.
After such a senseless and pointless death.
And unfortunately, I got spoiled. I was putting together the notes for this show and looking up the Wikipedia article and doing some links. And I was trying not to read anything, but then there was the bullet point stuff, and of course it said Tucker's death. I was like, ah, shit. And I was still, 6 or 8 episodes away from finishing season 4. So I was like, well, all right, I guess that kind of makes sense, but I don't know. Like I was hoping for something a little bit more valiant, you know?
Yes.
Because of the scrapes that they were finding themselves in season 4, it was really possible that one of the main characters could have died. Something that I really enjoyed about Battlestar Galactica is that you were on the edge of your seat watching that show, because none of the people in the credits are safe. Like, you watch the intro to the show and you're like, oh yeah, okay, here's the names that are popping up on the screen and their pictures and stuff like that. So I know none of them are going to die. And then you're like, oh, nope, I was wrong. And it just, every season, you just had no idea, you know, whether someone is in it for the 6-season haul or whether their 14 episodes are done. Like, it was really good. And I sort of felt like that with season 4, like, just because of the larger arcs and because of the perils that were involved, you kind of thought that it might happen. Especially when they started to really mix it up with other aliens, like Shran from Endurian, yeah, Endurian, yeah. And Tellarites and stuff like that was pretty tense, because there's the space battles, I think, is what keeps the tension high, because not very many vessels have shields at this point. It's all about polarized hull plating and armor, really. So a couple of good shots, and you're kind of a sitting duck. There's not much you can do. At one point, I think they're in Zindi space, and I don't know whether it's the reptiles or whether it's somebody else, but the Enterprise gets just messed up. And that was a cool thing to see, because in Next Generation, I mean, the Enterprise at that point is ginormous, and it's the flagship, and it's Big Brother. Like, you just, no one messes with him because they've got the capabilities to completely own face if they want to. But with these smaller ships, and I looked it up, like I looked up the size difference between the Enterprise D, I guess, or E in Picard's era, and then the NX-01 with Tucker and Archer and those guys. And it's considerable. Even the difference between the Enterprise with this series and the original series Enterprise size, it gets quite a bit bigger in terms of, especially with the warp nacelles and stuff like that. And something that I really enjoyed about Enterprise as well, they explained the science behind space travel way better in this series than any other Star Trek I've ever watched.
And they kind of needed to as well.
Yeah.
And one of the other things that they did was, they did plan out what they wanted to do with the ship. So, like with you saying about, how it gets all battered and everything. Season 5 was all supposed to be about the war with the Romulans.
Mm.
And the whole point is that it's just about managed to hold its own. They had a few minor upgrades, but the idea is going into that war, they would not stand a chance. So there was plans to actually add an extra hull at the bottom that makes it look a little bit more like the original Enterprise.
Oh, cool.
So they were kind of building down. So the nacelles would continue downwards, and you get this, this sort of rounded hull section for where the engineering would be.
Right.
And so it would have had major upgrades. and basically be completely refit and look even more close to like an evolution towards the original series Enterprise. And the official Starships collection, they make models for all of these stuff, and they've actually built a model based on that. And I have one, and it's absolutely fantastic, but it's basically official merchandise for how it would have looked. And it came with a guide that went through all of this in detail.
Oh, cool.
Which is pretty sweet. But it did make a difference in that series, having a Zati Prime where it's destroyed and then damaged, them actually dealing with it. When you look at Voyager, and Voyager was cleaned up every episode. And yeah. Was able to travel really long distances. Season 3, it made it feel like it was taking them a long time to get there. You know, for what would normally take an episode was taking them a season. Mm-hmm. And they were getting battered all the way through that. They weren't able to just polish it all up at the end of the episode and be all nice and shiny for the next one.
Yeah.
And that was a nice change.
Yeah. And people died. You know, like there's a giant explosion and, I mean, I can't remember what deck it was, E-deck or C-deck or something. And it's like, wow, well, so half of that deck exposed to space and you see the bodies mm-hmm. fly off and you're like, oh, shit, okay, this is bad. Like a lot of times it's just a bunch of people on set, on camera, shaking themselves back and forth to, you know, simulate a torpedo hit. But it was visceral with Enterprise, and you definitely felt it. You telling me that the show got canceled makes one of my... I get sad complaints about season 4 make a little bit more sense. I feel like Scott Bakula checked out. Mm. I enjoyed everybody's work on the show. I felt everybody and every character kind of grew throughout the whole series. It was Bakula, I felt, especially in season 4, got worse. Like he was just wooden and like phoning it in. And there was some opportunities in season 3 where it was really good. I'm not saying it was all bad, but I wonder if after the show got canceled, several people just kind of like, well, like I don't give a shit anymore.
It's quite possible. I mean, he didn't even want to sign on as a captain at first.
Really?
It was only when he was just like, oh, I don't want to be the next captain. That I'm not interested in at all. And then they went, it's going to be a prequel. It's going to be before Kirk. And he was instantly on board.
Huh.
That was what sold him on it. Just the fact that it was before Kirk that he would be the first.
Yeah. I enjoyed his interview with Shatner on the Captains, the documentary.
Yes.
I thought their talk was really, really cool because he's again, like, I mean, he's not on screen, so it's just an interview. Like it's like he's not on set. He's just doing a documentary interview, and he just seems so candid and at least a little bit more, I don't know, capable. Any kind of subtle stuff in Enterprise, he did fine. It was all of the more formal things that I found was very, like, really broad sweeping head motions and gestures and verbal delivery. It's like, you're not trying to reach the back of the room, man. Like, she's standing right there. Like some of the conversations in the ready room there for his captain's quarters on deck were just like, dude, like, just chill. You're behind closed doors. You're not putting on a show for anybody. You've been in space with the T'Pol for 4 years. Talk to her like a person, you know, like not a subordinate, you know, like it was a little bit, I think it was formal. I think that's the way that I should put it without sounding too critical. It was very formal considering how casual everybody else would interact with each other while still maintaining the chain of command.
Yes.
You know, like Tucker and Malcolm and Hoshi and all those guys would still maintain order and rank, but they would still speak like normal people that have been friends for 4 years. You know, like it was a little bit more balanced in that way. But anyway, I my final thoughts were that if you like Star Trek at all and you haven't seen Enterprise, I would absolutely encourage you to go see it. Season 2 is a little bit of a slog, but it picks up near the end and continues at that pace pretty much through the end of the series. So if you can get past the first, you know, a few bumps in end of season 1, beginning of season 2, then I think it's well worth it. It made me want to go watch other series that I don't remember, like Deep Space Nine and stuff.
Yeah, I'd almost argue that it's almost better to take a break between season 3 and season 4 and just watch the final episode before you watch the rest of season 4. Just get it out of the way. And I think it'll probably work a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah,
and just treat it as this is a Next Generation episode where they're just on a holodeck running a simulation that's based on events that happened, but it's not the actual thing.
It would have worked a lot better as a mid-season special nod, you know, like a Christmas thing or something cool where they want to give a lot of the people some time off or something fun like that. Yeah, no, yeah. I agree. I think, what did you call it? Was Terra Prime, I think, was the episode?
Yes, that was the penultimate episode. And that has a wonderful speech at the end. And if anything, really caps off the season really well. If had they ended it there, then it would have been pretty good. You kind of want to see the founding of the Federation, and it's not the Federation that they're founding, but it's still pretty close to that, and it's a wonderful speech, and I do not want to spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen.
I feel like there's some nods to like Prime Directive and stuff like that in there, and it I remember checking, because I had to pause it for some reason, probably a bathroom break or something like that. But I remember checking my episode list to see, like, is this the last one? Because it felt so final. Like, it felt so much like a season series finale that I was like, ooh, did I miss one? Like, where am I in this? Because I was just hitting next. Like, on Friday night when I didn't have any other responsibilities, I was just like, all right, got to go. Yeah, it was fun. So, yeah, I would highly recommend it. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of the Citadel Cafe. I have a quick pick that's going to be brought to you by our Patreon page at patreon.com/thecitadelcafe. If you like this show, you want to support what I'm doing here with my friends talking geeky stuff at you, then go to patreon.com/thecitadelcafe, become a patron. There's a fun Slack chat. It helps me with bills like the domain that's coming up to renew and Dropbox and all that kind of stuff. So head on over to Patreon, become a patron, and join the Slack chat, hang out with some cool folks there throughout the week. This is a quick pick that was actually from Alistair last year. It's epguides.com. I've mentioned it on the show before, but in the last week or so with all the new shows coming on television, I have found it absolutely essential for me to remember when they're airing, what the new nights are, whether I'm cut up or not cut up, and you can go and look up what the episodes are with no spoilers. It just gives you an air date and the title of the episode. So there's no risk.
Yeah, and I just have a couple of quick ones as well. One of them is memory-alpha.wikia.com. Memory Alpha is a completely dedicated Star Trek wiki. One of the things that I always love doing, especially if I'm rewatching an episode, is just going through and looking at the background information. It tells you so much about the writing process, all the stuff that was kind of going on, ideas that they had, how things became formulated. If you want to learn more about what was going on behind the scenes, it's easily the best website for a lot of that information. And similarly, if you wanted to know more of that kind of stuff about the films, there's a brilliant YouTube channel by a guy called Oliver Harper. I think I may have mentioned it before. He does a lot of retrospectives and reviews. Recently, he's been doing some Alien ones as well. But he's done, you know, most of the Star Trek movies as well. And he does some really amazing in-depth retrospectives for them. And they're definitely worth checking out.
Very cool. I've found that I've been using a lot of like wiki timelines and Star Trek websites, you know, the last few weeks, just kind of to keep my head in space. Like, when does this happen? How far ahead of Kirk and behind this? And when was Spock born? And like, because I was trying to answer some questions I had, like, I wonder if they're his parents. Like, well, all this kind of stuff came up. It's like, well, no, that's not close. Like, it's too far in the past. And it was an interesting time period that they chose for Enterprise. But that is the end. You can watch us live or listen to us live anyway here on thecitadelcafe.com every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern. You can channel alphageekradio.com for your mobile stream and credit Kevin MacLeod for doing the music for the show because he's awesome. I can't remember the name of his website, but it's always linked at the bottom of our show notes if you're curious about where to get some cool royalty-free music for your own podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook just by the show name, The Citadel Cafe. Same place to find me, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, all kinds of stuff, just my name. And of course, joelduggan.com. Look for some new prints coming before HalCon. So before November 4th at the big HalCon convention, I will have some more prints up in the store. Alistair, where can people go to find your stuff online?
They can find my old stuff at ohmyzod.com and hopefully new stuff at some point. And on Twitter, I am at imcfly.
You've been listening to The Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two. preferably Warp 2.
This podcast recorded before a live internet audience. To learn how to listen and watch live, visit tunein.alphageekradio.com.